Hi, I'm Dave Summers, and welcome to AMA's Edgewise, where you will hear fresh insights from recognized thought leaders across a wide range of subject matters. AMA's Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. The AMA is a global leader in professional development and education, improving the immediate performance and long-term growth of individuals and organizations. Check us out on our website, www.amanet.org. Anti-American feeling is at an all-time high. Other nations and cultures have regarded our businesses, our government, and our citizens with suspicion, resentment, even violence. In his book, Rebuilding Brand America, published by Amacom Books, Dick Martin argues that in today's global economy, American companies can no longer afford to overlook how anti-American sentiment affects their business. He then looks at how some of America's best companies have risen to this challenge, and in doing so, have thrived in international markets while being recognized as ambassadors of goodwill across the world. Dick was the Executive Vice President of Public Relations, Employee Communications, and Brand Management for AT&T. He has published articles in the Harvard Business Review and other media. Dick, what motivated you to write Rebuilding Brand America?
First, I should confess that I'm not a foreign policy expert. I'm not an economist. I'm not even a lawyer. But I did spend 32 years in public relations, advertising, and brand management. And following the events of 9/11, like many people, I was very concerned about what motivated some behavior that was so destructive. And first, I was surprised to find that America's reputation had been in decline well before the events of 9/11. In fact, I trace it all the way back to the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of communism, the end of the Cold War. But secondly, I came to the conclusion that this was more than a public policy issue. It was more than a PR problem. I came to the conclusion that America really had a broken brand, and that fascinated me. So I decided to look into it and see what might be done about it.
In what sense is America a brand?
Well, first, I ought to explain what a brand is not, because one of the things I discovered in researching this book is that there's a lot of confusion about it. A brand is not advertising. It's not a slogan. It's not nifty packaging. A brand is really the sum of everything that you think and feel about something. And I put a lot of emphasis on feeling, because brands are emotional. They describe an emotional relationship that people have with something, and that something could be a product, it could be a person, a celebrity, or, as in this case, a place, the United States of America. And it's important not to underestimate the power of emotion in branding. For example, the most famous incident, I think, in branding occurred when Coca-Cola tried to change from its historical formulation to a new formula. You may remember the Pepsi Challenge was worrying the executives of Coca-Cola in Atlanta, and they went as far as to change the formulation for Coke and announced New Coke, and it was a tremendous flop. People were so upset that Coca-Cola had been essentially taken away from them that they poured it down the sewer, and it was on all the news channels in the evening in all the newspapers, and eventually Coke had to back down. So a brand is really an emotional relationship between the United States, in this case, and people around the world.
What kind of research did you undergo, did you tap into to, you know, assess these global anti-American feelings?
There's a wealth of research. The Pew Center for Media does ongoing research on attitudes towards America around the world. The Zogby International has been specializing in assessing attitudes towards America and on a wide range of issues in the Arab world for years. The University of Michigan coordinates a World Values Survey that tries to use the same methodology to get at the underlying values that people in different countries have. So I didn't lack for data. There was plenty of data. And it all showed pretty much the same thing, a very consistent decline in America's reputation, in the way people feel about America over the last two decades, to the point that today people really think that the U.S. influence on the world is largely negative. If you went back to 2005, for example, in 2005, people were about evenly split. About half the people felt that America had a positive influence on the world, and half felt that its influence on the world was largely negative. In 2007, over half, 56%, believe that America's influence is largely negative, and less than a third, only 29%, believe that it's positive. That's a new time low.
If you ask people what their how they would define America, or the word capitalism would invariably, you know, bubble up. But as we know, there are various forms of capitalism now in the world, across the rest of the world. How does capitalism in America differ from capitalism in the rest of the world?
Well, in some remarkably interesting ways, capitalism is in vogue around the world. Even in China, there are people who are capitalists, and 80% of the leaders in Chinese villages are businessmen and entrepreneurs. So in that sense, attitudes toward the free market really are the dominant attitudes around the world, practically everywhere. There was a battle between communism and capitalism won. But it would be a mistake to think that we all approach capitalism in exactly the same way. And this really has to do with some very deep-seated values that people have that are slightly different outside the Anglo-Saxon world. If you ask people, which is more important to you, freedom or a safety net? That is, which is more important, that the government guarantee that nobody is in need, or that you be free of the government to pursue your own goals? In the United States, the majority of people, nearly 60%, say they would prefer to be free of government interference in their life, even if it means some people will be in need. In the rest of the world, something like two-thirds say that they think it's more important that the government guarantee that nobody be in need. They believe in more regulation of government to kind of even out the distribution of wealth. Well, the same thing happens when you talk about the free enterprise system. Around the world, two-thirds of people will say they favor free markets. For example, in India, some 44%, nearly half, say that they favor free markets. But when you ask them a very specific real-life application of free market principles, the response is quite different. For example, if you say, how do you feel about closing inefficient factories? All of a sudden, 78% of people in India say they would oppose closing inefficient factories. So in theory, almost half of them are in favor of free markets, but in the practical application, nearly three-quarters oppose the kinds of actions that you have to take in a free market, such as laying people off or closing factories.
Okay, so how specifically can U.S. businesses work together to address anti-Americanism? I mean, do they have to do anything to affect U.S. foreign policies, or should they just focus on the marketplace?
Well, the good news is that what American businesses need to do to succeed in global markets is exactly what they need to do to help rebuild brand America. They need to localize their products, they need to share their customers' concerns, and they need to share their customers' dreams. Let me tell you what I mean by those three things. Localizing products means listening to your customers. This is a lesson that the U.S. government could learn from American business. When P&G first entered the United Kingdom following World War II, they sent over crates of mint-flavored toothpaste, and they thought, well, this is going to be great. We don't even have to change the labeling on the package. They speak English just like we do, and our toothpaste will be just as successful in England as it as it is in the United States. Well, they were wrong. Nobody bought the toothpaste. And when they looked into it, they discovered why. The mint flavor of the toothpaste reminded the Brits of liniment. And liniment is something that you rub on aching muscles, not something you brush on your teeth. They really hadn't listened to their customers. They assumed people in England would buy the same things that people in the United States did. So when P&G entered China in the mid to late 80s, the first thing they did was to send researchers into people's homes. And they watched how the Chinese do their dishes, how they wash their hair, how they change the baby. And they used that information to change the formulation of their products. So now they sell a jasmine-flavored toothpaste in China because they learned that jasmine tea was thought to be good for bad breath. And because of that approach to the Chinese market, P&G is now the market leader in four of the seven segments in which they compete. So the very first thing that American business and the U.S. government needs to do is to get off transmit and to get on receive, really try to understand the values and the tastes and the customs and the traditions of people around the world and incorporate those not only into our messages but into our behavior abroad. The second thing is sharing people's concerns, people's cares. Some research that was done at Harvard a couple of years ago demonstrated and documented fairly extensively that global customers, people who deal with global companies, believe that global companies ought to be giving something back to the communities in which they do business. They don't expect the corner gas station to do something about global warming, but they do expect the giant oil companies to do something about it. They expect them to share their concerns and their cares. And successful American companies that do business outside the United States have learned that lesson, and they've put it to good use. Now, that doesn't mean they're just throwing money around to every good cause that pops up. They're looking for the intersection of their competencies and their interests and the interests of the communities in which they do business. So McDonald's, for example, is still true to its core values of food, family, and fun, but it is expressing that in all the markets in which it has restaurants in terms of what is important to the people of those communities. Their philanthropy, their good works, their community relations is still focused on children and children's causes, but those causes are different in China than they might be in India than they are in the United States. And finally, it's a question of sharing your customers' dreams. You know, America is a very different country than the other countries of the world. It wasn't started because we had a bunch of people who shared the same ethnicity or even the same language or who just happened to live close to one another. America started because of a common commitment to the same idea, and that idea was an idea of opportunity, the freedom to pursue opportunities, the idea that your success in life didn't depend on who your parents were. It depends on your own willingness to work hard and to take advantage of all of the opportunities that this country afforded. Well, that's an idea that really resonates with people around the world. You know, we've talked about how in many countries America is disliked, resented, unpopular. Well, even in the country that thinks the least of us on average, there are small pockets of people who favor the United States, who think highly of the United States. And when you look at these small groups of people across different countries, what you discover is they don't necessarily have the traditional demographic criteria in common. They aren't all low income. They aren't all high income. They aren't all well-educated. They aren't all poorly educated. But what they do have in common is they all think of themselves as upwardly mobile. They have in common a striving to better themselves in life, to take advantage of opportunities to make their children's lives better than their lives have been. That's America's constituency. That's what That's what these people have in common. It's really the American dream as translated to life in China or India or Saudi Arabia. And American companies need to tap in to those aspirations that people have. And the most successful American global companies have done that in the most powerful ways.
And what would you most like readers to take away from Rebuilding Brand America?
You know, there are three things that I'd like people to take away from this book. One is that America's brand is broken. The second is that that matters. It's a big deal, and we need to do something about it. And third, and perhaps most importantly, we can do something about it. There are companies today that are doing a lot about it. The government, I think, is beginning to recognize the depths of the problem, and they're willing to learn from successful American companies. So on balance, I'm cautiously optimistic.
It's once again time for You've Been Spotted, where we interview random people who are attending a workshop or seminar at one of our five executive conference centers. For more information on our executive conference centers and seminars, please visit our website, www.amanet.org. And here's Kevin Lee.
Today at the AMA Center, I'm speaking to some of the seminar attendees who work for multinational companies about what it's like as Americans working with other cultures.
I work for a company based in Japan, and we're a distributor here in the United States. Well, I've worked for this company and an American company in the same industry. In the American company, it was, what is going to happen this quarter? Are we going to make the numbers? What do we have to do to make the numbers this quarter? In the Japanese company, it is, in 50 years, what is our reputation going to be? Always keeping in mind the customer is not king, the customer is God. It is a very hands-off operation because there is such a small turnover of personnel. Everybody knows their job. Most of the people I work with have been at the company for 10 or 20 years, as opposed to the American company where I was at, where the turnover was about 5 years. Once you're a part of this company, you are part of the family, and you are taken care of for 20 years, as opposed to the other company where I was told at one point I was replaceable.
We were in the World Trade Center, and a number of us escaped, walked down 80 flights of stairs, etc. And as a trading company, we had a webcam on our trading floor. So our London office observed us in New York, escaping, basically saying, you know, we're leaving. You know, all of us left, and a number of the people in our company perished, and that affected our company and how we rebuilt from there. So, you know, that has affected us dramatically. It's changed us forever. It will never, never be the same as it was before. I would say from an HR perspective, some of the issues we had was, you know, dealing with discrimination of Muslims. You know, when we hire people where, you know, I always train my people, you're colorblind, you're et cetera, being fair. But I can see that some people look at the name on the resume. And some of the Americans, some of the Brits were very, very anxious about the fact that we did have Muslims working in our company, people from Iraq in our company, very, very nervous. Our HR is very, very active in the field talking. Every day I talk to the people. Same thing in my other locations. So we just, you know, say, look, that person is not different from yesterday. You just have to deal with him the same that you did before.
It would be great to hear your feedback on this program. So please drop us an email note at podcast@amanet.org or call us at 800-697-3406. That's 800-697-3406. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.